Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast. How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by the Salty Dogs? Y'all like the Salty Dogs? Hailing from Little Rock, Arkansas, the Salty Dogs have shared the stage with Willie Nelson, Kinky Friedman, Hank Williams Jr., Old Crow Medicine Show, and Junior Brown, among others. Their music has been featured on TLC's Trading Spaces. They have CDs for sale after the show, and more can be heard at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark was a featured house guitarist for the late Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi. He wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Our featured artist tonight is Little Rock painter Doug Norton, with his portraits of Robert Johnson, Elvis Presley, and Junior Kimbrough, all of which are for sale. Our listeners can find out more about these paintings and Doug at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? This week, our stories revolve around words. What we hear, what we think we hear, and what we wish we didn't hear. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who lived them. Later tonight, Paul Strack considers words he'd never thought he'd hear from a teenager. And we'll end the night with Carrie Jackson Case, her preschooler, and some words that are recited quite differently than they were originally spoken. But let's start the night with Melanie Baden, as it's not what she says, but the way she says it that becomes an asset in A Change of Perspective.
You could have heard a pin drop when Miss Enfinger passed out the grades. Reeves, McReynolds, and I waited like potential lottery winners as the ball spun around in the washing style grate. Miss Enfinger stretched out her arm with a smile so gentle I thought she was going to hand me a plate of warm cookies, fresh from the oven, but instead it was my paper, just as sweet. I got 100. I glanced across the room as Miss Enfinger handed Reeves her paper. The upturned corner of Reeves' lips and the look of Cheshire told me she got 100 too. Third grade, I learned both what it was like to be jealous and envious, and also what the smell of death looked like. I was very fond of Miss Enfinger. In my mind, she seemed very old at the time. She was probably barely 50, but she grayed early and wore age on her heavy ashen face. Still, beyond craggy creases and near-death sheen, she was warm and caring. She was much like a beautiful elderly innkeeper instead of a third-grade schoolteacher. Miss Enfinger was my first real encounter with mortality. Before wooden desks, number two pencils, and a classroom full of emerging and gregariously chattering elementary students, she battled breast cancer. Reeves was my longtime rival when it came to spelling tests. Well, I guess as long as you can call it in the third grade. Her hair was the color of bourbon when the sun shone through it. It made those beautiful sparkles that glimmer when light moves across it. And her skin, well, her skin was as porcelain as any doll I had ever seen. And I knew what that meant. It meant she was wealthy. I had already read enough turn of the century, antebellum, Gone with the Wind type books to know that fair skin was a sure sign of wealth. Meant they didn't have to work or nothing. So the sun rarely shone on them. She was even slightly pudgy, as I read was another indicator of wealth. Always plenty of food to go around. She even lived in a stately house with a just-as-green-as-money 3-acre front yard that stretched on until it touched the road where the yellow school bus I rode past by it every morning when I went to school, a daily reminder of our vast differences. Me, well, I was just the opposite. Every time the sun shone on me, I turned the ripe color of an acorn, and I was as skinny as what my grandmother would call a rail. Or if she thought she was being real funny, she'd say chicken legs. Nothing but knees and toothpicks with a little meat. And my feet, they were the color of kumquats. Because I rarely wore shoes and I liked the way they felt when they squished between my toes. And what could I say about the color of my hair? It was the color of drying wheat. Or dying wheat. And would twirl up in what my mom would call rat's nest, that looked a little like the mistletoe we'd shoot from the trees with BB guns while we was camping. And my house was on Sunset Drive, which was the most flattering thing about it. It had chipping yellow paint, and I'm pretty sure we rented. And I don't care what my mom and stepdad told me, I was sleeping in the attic. Not upstairs, because every time I raised up in the morning, that slanted ceiling would hit me straight in the head. Reeves and I couldn't have been any more opposite, but we had one thing in common, that's for sure. We liked hundreds. The competition with Reeves and I continued on until my sister and I moved in with my dad. We didn't take too kindly to my stepdad, and he surely didn't take too kindly to us. My sister and I left a few switches and belts out of business and unemployed when we vacated the house on Sunset Drive, but we never looked back, not once. My daddy liked money, and he liked to look like we had money. Everything I own now had a monogram on it. I think he had had my socks monogrammed if he thought he could. And once those alligators moved on, well, men on horses found their way onto our shirts. Daddy went everywhere the money went. First to Alabama, then to Tennessee, then back to Alabama, then to Mississippi. Then, yes, the money got so good. The summer before I started the 11th grade, we moved straight from Pearl, Mississippi, up north to downtown Chicago, Illinois. By this time, I had completely lost interest in hundreds. Fashion and boys had taken up residence where books and pencils once resided. Now, don't get me wrong. I love school. In fact, I loved it so much, I got up every morning at 4 a.m. just to get prepared for it. Maybelline Lush Lashes, Aquanet, Gloria Vanderbilt jeans, white shoulder perfume, a hot curling iron, and lip gloss that tasted like fruit became morning staples in my ritual. Why, in fact, I had even ordered a sun lamp from Service Merchandise. Who'd have thought looking like an acorn would become so fashionable? So that summer at high school registration in Chicago, which seemed more like college registration compared to the southern way we had done it in Mississippi, Dean Dallinger handed me a map of the school. Seriously, it looked like a map of the malls I had frequented. Although by now I had already memorized where Things Remembered, Kirkland's, Spencer's, and Wicks and Sticks were. After whispering, like gossip, to Dean Dallinger, a teacher leaned over to the dean and said to me, "Honey, the boys are going to love you and the girls are going to hate you." I had no idea what this woman was talking about. I said, "Ma'am?" Which was like speaking Chinese to a Canadian. And before she could even answer, I said, "What?" Which was like cussing at an adult from what my dad had told me. Nonetheless, I felt like she was asking for it. She just said, "Your accent, that's all. The boys will love it." I had an accent?
Melanie Baden resides in Stuttgart, Arkansas. She is the director of the Museum of the Arkansas Grand Prairie, has been the featured author in Poesia magazine, and is the author of the book Skullgrass, a compilation of poetry. She has been voted Best of Creative Writing 6 times in the Grand Prairie Arts Festival. Melanie has 3 children, Morgan, Jake, and David, and 1 cat named Sunshine. In our next story, Paul Strack's home is invaded by someone else's teenagers and their words in Rainbow Cheerios.
Cool. You have Rainbow Cheerios? Those words, coming from a teenager, awakened me on a Thursday morning. Not my own teenager, mind you, but someone else's, and I was stunned. As odd as it may sound, our family has been blessed during an onslaught of wicked weather. On the night of April 26, 2011, after the tornadoes made their way through the Mayflower, Arkansas area, text messages between our 13-year-old daughter and her friend became increasingly frantic. Her friend's house was damaged. Part of the garage was missing. Daylight the following day confirmed the fears. Her friend's house had been destroyed. As we all do whenever anyone suffers a loss, we ask, what can we do to help? Often, the victims typically, yet graciously, decline as they are still suffering from the shock of it all. And often, because we don't know what else to do, we send food. It makes everyone feel better. So we ask the questions, and we're prepared to bring lots of food. Except the answer didn't stick to the script. What the family needed most was someplace for their daughters to stay while their parents sorted things and sorted things out. So for the next 3 days, we welcomed 2 more teenagers into our home, and the blessings began. Rachel, the 13-year-old, attends school with our daughter. Taylor is 15, and she is a former classmate of our 15-year-old son. So it's not like we were bringing total strangers into our home. But what was so strange was their attitude. With 3 teenagers of our own, and a 10-year-old to boot, we have a pretty good understanding of the adolescent attitude. What was odd and completely unexpected was the positively bubbly, effervescent attitude that these 2 brought with them. And to have this attitude after immediately being displaced was nothing short of remarkable. So my first awkward attempt in making the girls feel comfortable when they arrived was to say how sorry I was for their loss. I hate that phrase, yet I use it frequently at funerals and at the casinos. Without hesitation, Taylor replied, "Oh well, what are you gonna do? It's just a bump in the road." Rachel quickly chimed in, "Yeah, they will bulldoze our house and we will get to rebuild. And anyway, Mom will finally get to get her new carpet." "What are you gonna do? A bump in the road we get to rebuild?" For starters, I would cry, curse, blame, and lament about the fact that we have to rebuild. That would have been my reaction. I just brushed off their responses as being in a state of shock. Normal teenagers don't act that way. So as we ended the evening, they prepared themselves for bed without being told. They gathered and completed their schoolwork before going to bed. I didn't realize that was possible. And they told my wife and I good night. I'm not sure if our 18-year-old has done that since the second Harry Potter movie. The next morning, I awoke to more animated conversation. Normally, I awake to panic-stricken mumbling and instructions. My wife offered to make the kids whatever special breakfast they wanted. But like our own children, thankfully, they opted for the meals ready to eat in our pantry. Cold cereal, Pop-Tarts, and instant breakfast. Usually this selection doesn't cause much reaction or interaction with our own children, but today would be different. Over the murmuring and grumbling of our children, I heard Rachel exclaim, "How cool! I immediately thought that maybe our instant breakfast selection now included white chocolate mocha. Or maybe the Pop-Tarts now included microwave instructions. But no, it was a revelation even more startling. Rachel repeated, "How cool. You guys have rainbow Cheerios." Okay, I do frequently visit our pantry. And believe me, if there was something as earth-shattering as rainbow Cheerios, I would have known about it. Because of our children's inquisitive nature, they are always asking, "Why do I have to?" or "How come I have to?" They immediately challenged Rachel's revelation with a resounding, "Huh?" Any legitimate cereal aficionado knows that there really is no such thing as rainbow Cheerios. You see, we often buy our more popular cereals in bulk and empty the contents into plastic containers so they stay fresh. And no, my own Fiber One is not one of those. But we often do buy Fruit Loops. You know, those sweet and sugary rings full of all the colors of the rainbow. Cheerios have the honey nut version, the frosted version, the banana nut version, and now even the multigrain version, but no rainbow version, except through the eyes of Rachel. Two days after her house was destroyed by a tornado, she was still able to find complete joy in a bowl of multicolored cereal. A few days later, more rain and high water and floods came. Rachel and Taylor's property was now being encroached upon by rising waters, so their parents asked if they could stay with us for another day or so. When we rendezvoused for the exchange, the girls jumped in our car and gleefully exclaimed, "We're back." And so were the rainbows.
Paul Strack is a native Arkansan residing in Maumelle for the past 25 years. He and his wife, Lisa, have four children. Paul is president of Custom XM, a marketing services firm in North Little Rock. In our final story of the night, Carrie Jackson Case drops her toddler off at school, and her words take on a life of their own in "Have a Good Day."
It's not that my son is a liar. It's that his version of the truth makes me sound like a lunatic. And quite frankly, I need no help in that department. When he began preschool, his darling teacher told us, "I won't believe everything he tells me if you won't believe everything he tells you." That seemed like a fair enough arrangement. There's a reason 3 and 4-year-olds are not reliable witnesses. Time is not linear, and the answer they are giving could be a question you asked last Thursday. Bargains aside, I'm reasonably certain by the time we left, she thought I was a drug-addicted madam who hates Jesus. It all started very innocently. In fact, it all started because I was trying to be a good parent. I wasn't succeeding or anything, but I was trying. Jackson saw me taking allergy medication one morning. He asked me about it. We had the talk about how he should never take medicine that doesn't belong to him because it could make him sick. Then he got worried that I might get sick. I told him everything would be fine as long as mommy takes her medicine and Jackson takes his medicine. We just can't mix them up. I was feeling like a perfectly respectable parent. I felt like I had an after-school special kind of moment. Kind of moment all those red ribbon weeks of my own youth had prepared me for, until I dropped him off. He looked up at his teacher with his big brown eyes, and he told her, "Everything is fine as long as mommy takes her medicine." I stammered, and I tried to explain our conversation. I told her it was about appropriate use of medication, but it really sounded like a college girl swearing she wasn't drunk, so I just dropped it. I really think everything would have been fine if that had been all. But for what after reason, about that time, he began to call everything with a hook, a hooker. It seems logical enough, just slightly bawdy. Tow trucks were usually the defamed parties. He had a particular pair of shorts that had a hook rather than a snap, and I don't know why, you could ask the clothing manufacturer. When I was helping get him dressed one day, I wanted to be sure he could work it so there were no potty incidents. He declared with a great deal of satisfaction, "I can work the hooker in my pants." I overpronounced hook for the rest of the morning, hoping it would stick, but I'm not that kind of lucky. Upon arrival, he proudly announced to his classmates his deaf skills with the hooker in his pants, adding proudly, "My mama taught me." That's great, kid. Super. Again, with the explanations of snaps versus hooks, be careful with bathroom breaks. More nervous laughter. She just sort of stared blankly at me. Okay, the next episode was probably a little bit my own fault. Okay, well, it was all my own fault. But Jackson was lollygagging one morning, and I told him to pick up the pace, which it turned into, why do we have to go to school and work every day? And I popped off immediately, because we're regular taxpayers, son. Now put your shoes on. While performing the world's slowest shoe tying routine, he ventured further, "But on Sundays, we go to church." We were already late at this point, so again with the flip answer, "Yes, we do, because we're God-fearing people. Get in the car!" My husband looked stunned. "Why would you say that?" I was confused. "What? What did I say?" He turned and walked away smugly. "Just wait," he predicted. "Just wait." It took about 2 days for that to circle back around. The precious, pious, Pentecostal woman with the white bun on her head approached me rather timidly. "Is there something going on at church or something?" I told her I didn't follow. "Well, Jackson tells me you're afraid of God." Of course he did. You know, what with the drugs and the prostitutes, my relationship with God has been a little rocky these days. "No," I said, "we're God-fearing people." I trailed off. This was just all too much. My husband got to say, "I told you so," and I really did try to watch my mouth. Things went pretty smoothly for several months. I started to feel like maybe I was rehabilitating my soiled reputation. Then I found a box of old toys in the attic. I pulled them down because Jackson was about the right age for them. He saw the box in the closet. I told him to leave them alone because I hadn't had a chance to wash the toys after quite literally decades in storage. When I dropped him off at school that day, he told his teacher with all sincerity, "Mommy has a box of dirty toys in her closet." "But she won't let me play with them." And there it was. There is nothing I could do to make that better. So I said the only thing a person can say in that situation, "Have a good day."
Carrie Jackson Case only takes medication prescribed by her physician. The junior league dropout lives in Little Rock with her husband, son, and two untrainable dogs. If you're around at supper time, she'll feed you. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Stitcher, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. We are currently open for submissions from Southerners. For more information, go to talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
We're the Southie Dogs right here in Little Rock. We're glad you're here. And here's a song we probably haven't played in about 10 years.
Well, I gave her a kiss and I gave her a hug. And we kept loving in a lifetime of love. And I gave her a kiss and I gave her a hug. And we got the love in a lifetime of love. Well, they teach you in school that one plus one is two. And change the Y to I. And there's exceptions to the rule. But never talk to strangers.
Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.